Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you are doing well. Thanks for joining me this morning for The Morning Break, live from Liverpool. On this morning's show, we're discussing compassionate leadership with Michael A. West, CBE. All things compassion in the workplace. There's a lot more to it than that. Stay with us. Text in, call in, get involved in the conversation live on Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, everybody, on this sunny... Well, it was sunny. We've had huge storms overnight in Liverpool, but it was pleasant until last night. It's been quite predictable in the sense that the weather's been fantastic on the return to school, which has been brilliant. I'm actually joined this morning by Michael West. I know Michael is already in the studio, so hit call in, Michael, whenever you wish to. But I'm really, really excited about being joined by Michael. It's been, I think, actually, I initially spoke to Michael back in July. Good morning, Michael. Are you with us? Can you hear me okay?
Good morning, Tom. Yes, I'm with you.
Excellent news. How are you this morning? Are you good?
Yeah, lovely. It's still, I'm in Sheffield here, and it's still sunny and warm, but those thunderstorms are on the way, I think.
Oh, unlucky, because it was quite dramatic last night. Felt like the world was closing in, and it was at the end times. Listen, thank you so much for kind of giving up your time to come on Teachers Talk Radio and talk about this topic that I'm really interested in, which is compassionate leadership. And we're going to be drawing on the work that you yourself have done across particularly in your recent book, Compassionate Leadership, Sustaining Wisdom, Humanity and Presence in Health and Social Care. And actually, even though it's in health and social care, we are going to be kind of applying, if you like, the thoughts and experiences in this book to education. And I'm going to be kind of feeding in some of my own experiences into this as well. I've got a lot of questions for you, but before we do that, a little introduction, just so listeners know who they're listening to. And if you are listening live, then you can text in at any point during the show. You can text in a question, tell us where you're listening from, and get involved in the conversation. But Michael is a CBE. He is a King's Fund Senior Fellow since 2013. The King's Fund is an independent charitable organization working to improve healthcare. He's also the Professor of Work and Organizational Psychology at Lancaster University, the Visiting Professor at University College Dublin, and the Emeritus Professor at Aston University. And also, Michael has authored and edited 20 books and published 200 articles, more than 200 articles, on teamwork, leadership, and culture. Wow, Michael, I'm exhausted after that. Like, I think it's the end of the show.
It sounds very grand, doesn't it? But truly, my first job when I finished university was working as a labourer in a coal mine in South Wales for a year. And wow. I think that's given me enough humility to last a lifetime. It was a great experience. And
How did that come about?
I'd been at university for quite a few years, living probably a bit of a dissolute life, and had no money left. And
yeah.
I was at university in South Wales, and just by chance, my partner was working with the sister of a colliery manager. And she said, I can get him a job so he can make some money. And so I got a job as a labourer, did basic training in a coal mine for a few weeks, and then went and worked underground. And I decided that academia was probably more pleasant than working underground after a year.
I was going to say that must have been some experience. Am I allowed to ask what year that was, so people can work out your age?
It was I'm 70 now. That was in 1977, 78.
Wow.
Oakdale Colliery, South Wales. That's of course, amazing. No collieries left in Wales.
No, I was going to say that's why I was asking about the year because we're definitely going back. That's amazing. That's incredible. Wow, didn't know that. That should be like a fun fact that people bring out in future interviews with you. You know. So listen, the book. Let's go straight into this. The book on compassionate leadership. Can I start with kind of what's driven you to write this book? Because I know you've written other books. But this one on compassionate leadership, sustaining wisdom, humanity, and presence. What drove you to write this one?
So it was a labor of love. And having this time and space during the lockdown gave some space to really get on with it and commit to it. But I suppose what really drives me is the recognition that a huge number of our health and social care staff are suffering day in, day out from trying to manage demands way beyond the resources they've got available, and that's causing a huge amount of stress. And it's chronic, it's not just transient stress, it's chronic. And we know that that has a huge impact on their health, on cancers, addictions, diabetes, depression, and sadly, early mortality. And it causes, of course, severe mental health problems, which spill over into people's lives. And we know that, you know, certainly over the last few years, the levels of stress have been rising. And these are people who are dedicating their lives for caring for the health and well-being of others. And that chronic stress also has a huge impact on quality of care that they can provide, on patient safety and care outcomes. So it felt to me that, you know, what we were seeing in health and social care was very high levels of stress, very high levels of staff quitting. One in four nurses leave within 3 years of joining the NHS.
Wow.
And very high levels of absenteeism and intention to quit. And of course, what that creates is high levels of vacancies. Before the pandemic, there were 100,000 vacancies in the NHS and 100,000 in social care as well. So this seems to me a really clear indication of a failure of leadership in our health and care services. And let me say in passing that I'm aware that amongst teachers, levels of stress are similarly high. I know the Health and Safety Executive annual report show that teachers are under very similar levels of stress to health and social care staff. So it felt like, you know, there has been a real failure of leadership over the years in our health and care services. And we need to transform the way we run these organizations. And from all that I had learned, I guess, over the course of my career, it had come, in a way, come to a focal point to say, you know, compassion's really fundamental in human behavior. We're hardwired to be compassionate. Health and social care services are about compassion. So compassion should be at the heart of our cultures and leadership. And that really was the springboard for the book.
Yeah. I mean, some shocking figures there. I mean, I have to say, not surprising based on what you read about, you know, the crisis in health and social care in terms of staffing, but still some pretty shocking statistics. Now, your answer, one of your answers to this is obviously to look at leadership, and in particular, this idea of compassionate leadership. So can you tell me what compassionate leadership is and what it isn't, first?
So that's, it's a really clear question, and I want to give a really clear answer. And in practice, compassionate leadership is four things. It's paying attention to those we lead, and by that I mean being present with them and giving attention. And there's a lovely phrase that Nancy Klein, who writes about human interactions, uses, listening with fascination. The first element of compassionate leadership is attending or listening with fascination. And then the second, sorry, go on.
No, you carry on.
And the second is then seeking to understand the challenges that those we lead face, not by imposing some, you know, hierarchical senior management understanding, but through a dialogue coming to a shared understanding. And you know, that might mean conflicting perspectives, but that's what seeking understanding is. And third is empathizing, is feeling with the other person who's under stress or who's in pain or who's having difficulties, without being overwhelmed by those feelings. And that empathy gives us the motivation for the fourth critical element of compassion, which is helping or serving the other person. And from a leadership perspective, helping means helping to remove the obstacles and or helping to ensure people have the resources they need, the right numbers of staff with the right skills, the right equipment, the right training and development and supports and so on. So very simply, compassionate leadership is attending, understanding, empathizing, and then helping.
Yeah.
And what it's not is, you know, some soft cushions and scented candles approach to leadership. On the contrary, I think it requires a lot more authenticity and courage than the rather easy opt-out of directive, command and control leadership. So a couple of things about compassion. One is that we know from neuroscience studies that if you ask people to be empathic towards somebody who's in pain or in difficulty or in distress, that is associated with the activation of various pain centers in the brain.
Yeah.
Where when you ask somebody to be compassionate with that additional element of helping, that's associated with the activation of reward centers in the brain. And that makes sense because, you know, we've been hardwired as a species to be compassionate. It's what enables us to connect, to feel a sense of belonging, of trust, of safety, particularly at difficult times as we've experienced during the pandemic. And so compassion is something that's hardwired into us. We feel better when we help other people, when we're kind to other people. And so compassionate leadership is simply incorporating that into the way we lead, rather than adopting some, you know, status-driven, hierarchical kind of approach to leadership.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I just want to delve into those in a little bit more detail. So with regards to the first one, which is this idea of listening with fascination, which you mentioned, and kind of being attentive and so on. I mean, do you think this is a problem with, like, the psychology of people today not being able to be present in the moment? Or do you think it's a workload problem that is blocking that from happening more?
So I think it's both, Tom. I think that we are now so bombarded with different stimuli. I often reflect, you know, when, if you think of the last, you know, in my lifetime, the last 70 years, the number of sources of stimulation that we can access now has multiplied exponentially through the use of technology. So there is this kind of, I suppose people talk about a lot, this short attention span way of engaging.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, actually, when people go into nature, into forests or by the sea or by rivers, that stillness people find is incredibly nurturing and nourishing. Mm. You know, we know from research evidence that spending time in nature where there isn't that perpetual, as it were, stimulation from multiple sources, that induces a sense of presence. So I think there's something to do with not taking the time to be still, not enjoying or savoring being present. And secondly, you know, the problem of chronic workload, work overload is, I think, huge in society. I was talking to somebody yesterday who was somebody that I mentor who was saying, I've got one point today where I've got seven meetings in my diary. And we know that chronic work overload is the number one predictor of staff stress. It's the number one predictor of staff intention to quit. And I think it's become a bit like, you know, like the pattern on the wallpaper that we don't see anymore. but it is causing such damage to our health and well-being and our ability to connect with each other. And I think leaders, and in, I'm sure this is true in schools, it's certainly true in health and social care, leaders are often reluctant to talk about work overload because they feel they don't have solutions. But actually, it's the key issue that we're facing in terms of people's well-being in workplaces, and we must talk about it and we must deal with it.
Yeah, I think in education we've got similar. Obviously, we have the workload issue, through the system, which prevents real good quality conversations going on. For the simple fact that people just do not have the time; they're preoccupied with what they have to do next. And there is not that opportunity to actually sit down with someone and engage in a conversation that finds out truth, which can take time. You know, because if you ask someone a basic question, yeah, how are you feeling today? And then they give you an answer, you know, quite often you're going to, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert, but you're going to have to follow up on that. And you're going to have to delve into, you know, that conversation. If you're a manager or a leader with someone in your team, you're going to have to take time to actually have that conversation. And I think one of the principles you talk about in the book is spending time with team members. And I've written down on my notes a big kind of question of why. Why is spending time with the people in your team important to compassionate leadership?
So you're absolutely right. The spending time in that conversation, the being present, the seeking to understand, the empathizing, the getting alongside, the experiencing what the other's experiencing, that's leadership. And not having those conversations because I've got too many things to do, I've got too many meetings to go to, I've got too many documents that I need to read, is a failure of leadership. And so... Why it's so important to spend time with team members is if we look at all of the leadership literature in, you know, across industries over the last 60 or 70 years, I would say, well, it's two things. One is these four behaviors I've talked about, attending, understanding, empathizing, and helping, come out repeatedly as the behaviors that characterize effective leadership. So we can see it as in the data, in the research on what constitutes effective team leadership, we can see it in organizations about the link between these behaviors. If you take the retail sector, the link between these leadership behaviors and staff satisfaction, which it's called a kind of value chain. Staff satisfaction affects customer service affects customer satisfaction, customer loyalty, productivity, and profitability.
Yeah.
So the work of people like Ben Schneider in the States over many years has demonstrated that really clear value chain. So these behaviors are critical to effective leadership, and it's no coincidence they're the same as the behaviors that the work of people like Paul Gilbert and University of Derby shows are the constituent elements of compassion. Why? Because they're the behaviors that enable us to feel a sense of connection and belonging and trust. And I guess very simply, you know, what the leadership literature tells us is the most important skill of a leader is listening. You know, that's what the last 60 years, 70 years of leadership research has probably demonstrated, really, is the most important skill of a leader is listening. And the most important task of a leader is helping those they lead to do their jobs effectively, which is what the vast majority of people want to do. And that helping means helping them by removing the obstacles that get in the way of them. You know, educating children or help ensuring that they have the resources they need to do their jobs effectively.
Of course. And just before we go to our first very quick break, can you give me a few examples of scenarios that you may have witnessed personally that might demonstrate compassionate leadership in practice?
Well, you know, I guess examples I would pick would be from what I've seen during the course of the pandemic this last year. I mean, you know, all of us have seen examples that have moved us to tears of compassionate leadership and compassion. The two I wanted to share with you is Northumbria Healthcare, where I've been doing a lot of work over the last 5 or 6 years, they had a COVID Facebook page for all their staff so that they could pick up quickly on problems their staff were experiencing and respond to them. And one of the things they discovered early on, not surprisingly, was that people were really frightened about catching COVID and because there was inadequate PPE equipment.
Yeah.
So the leadership team made the decision to build a factory and hire local people as cutters and sewers. And they did that in the space of about 2 weeks. They found premises, they built on, and they produced 2.5 million gowns in the space of the next month and a half to supply their staff and also other organizations in the NHS. They also created a community bank within the organization, because many of the staff, their partners had lost their jobs because of the pandemic. And they didn't want them to fall into the hands of, you know, payday loan companies.
Yeah.
They created a community bank. And those seem to me to be wonderful examples of compassionate leadership in the middle of a crisis. It was like, to hell with what the national rules are and who we've got to go for. We just get on and do this. And there was so much of that during the pandemic, which was courageous, wise, and compassionate.
Wow, fantastic. If you're just joining us live, by the way, I'm with Michael West. We're discussing compassionate leadership in all its forms and aspects. Welcome to Jake and Greg and Tanapat and Usam, and there's lots of other people in the live studio at the moment. So welcome to you, and I hope you're having a good morning. We'll be back, Michael, in about 2 seconds after this quick commercial.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts, or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique, challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors, and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles, and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website, www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club.
Hi, you are back with us on Teachers Talk Radio. I'm in conversation with Michael West. Michael, how are you doing? Are you still with us?
Yeah, good. I'm with you and enjoying the conversation, Tom. Thank you.
Fantastic. What I want to move on to next is a kind of difficult issue, I guess, which is toxic behaviours in teams and between team members. And it's something that you write about in the book. And I was wondering, what do you think causes toxic behaviours in teams and between team members? And how do we deal with that in a compassionate way as a leader?
So the first thing I would say is that we tend to attribute toxic behaviors to people's personalities. So we tend to see when somebody's behaving aggressively or unpleasantly or cynically, the first thing we tend to do is to say, well, that's the sort of person they are. In psychology, it's called the fundamental attribution error. It's a bit of a jargon, but it's saying that, you know, typically what we do is we blame people for their behavior, so who they are, rather than the situation they find themselves in. But actually what psychology tells us is most behavior is a consequence of the situation that people find themselves in. Of course, there are people who are toxic in terms of being narcissistic or bullies or, you know, always angry and aggressive. But for the most part, people's behavior is determined by the situation they find themselves in. And that's often been a consequence of really working in, you know, difficult situations over many years. So in teams, what I've seen over the years typically is that problem behaviors are often a consequence of teams not having clear objectives or clear goals, you know, four or five clear goals, which so that people are clear about what they are required to do, not having clear roles within the team, not being given helpful feedback on a regular basis. And you know, a very common failing, the simple failure of teams to meet regularly to review what it is they're trying to do and how they're going about it. So the starting point, I think, is addressing those issues in teams. What are the goals? Are people clear about their roles? Are they getting the information they need, and are they meeting regularly as teams? The second thing is that, you know, conflict is inevitable in teams. Chronic interpersonal conflict is simply a disaster, and all of us working in the public sector or indeed in any work organization, we should all be really clear that allowing interpersonal friction, which happens inevitably from time to time, but allowing that to become chronic and embedded has really negative consequences for the people involved, for the rest of the team, and in the case of education, for children, students, and in healthcare, of course, for patients. There are other conflicts that occur in teams, you know, conflicts about the task, what we should be doing, how we should be doing it, who's in charge here. And those conflicts are inevitable. I always say that, you know, if you're not having conflicts in your team or organization, then you're not really innovating. You're not looking for new and improved ways of doing things. But it's when those conflicts are not leaned into and managed well in a positive, courageous, transparent, ethical, compassionate way that they can spill over into interpersonal conflicts and become particularly toxic and damaging.
Do you think there's a sense that some leaders will avoid dealing with kind of toxic behaviors out of fear, out of kind of, I mean, we'll come on to difficult conversations in a minute, but do you think there is that element of, do you know what, this is too big for me to deal with, and that's why I'm not dealing with it?
Yeah, I think leaders are often afraid of dealing with these difficult behaviors. And the problem with that is they don't go away and they continue to infect the organization and they continue to affect the outcomes for the people that we serve. But, you know, I said earlier that compassionate leadership is not some soft cushions and scented candles approach to leadership, because ultimately that compassionate leadership is for the people we serve, the children, the students, the patients, the service users. And so compassionate leadership is about being effective as a leader. And that means really prioritizing providing high quality education, learning experiences, or in the case of healthcare, high quality care for the people that we serve. And that means that those behaviors, which we know damage outcomes, must be addressed. So that's, you know, that's why I said compassionate leadership requires, I think, much more authenticity and courage than the kind of directive, command and control leadership that very often just avoids dealing with toxic behaviors.
Yeah, so there's got to be that element of honesty, I guess, is what you're saying, to deal with these issues. Yeah.
Yeah, because as you, you know, as you were saying earlier, you know, it's about being present with others, and that means being honest. You know, being present means seeing the reality out there and being honest about it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's delve a bit more, a bit further into this now, because obviously sometimes there will be times where difficult conversations have to take place with team members. So what is compassionate leadership of difficult conversations? What does that mean?
I think it means having difficult conversations courageously. And that means, yeah, we'll maybe talk about self-compassion later, but it means that I talk about seven steps that are really important. The first is to think positively about the conversation. This is an opportunity to help the individual concerned or the individuals concerned. And you know, it's about making a difference. It's going to be a constructive conversation. So having positive expectations. Second is staying present and calm. We've talked about that. You asked about presence earlier. I think compassionate leadership is not some bolt-on set of behaviors. It's a way of being. It's about being present in the moment. And we talked about being present in nature and feeling that calmness. Well, in a similar way, being present in the conversation and feeling the calm of presence and stillness. Third is, it's good to plan the conversation. A few key bullet points. You know, what you don't want is to present people with an overwhelming list of all of the, you know, 20, 30, 40 things that you're unhappy about. A few key bullet points, simple, clear, direct conversation. It should describe behavior and the consequences of people's behavior and not, make personal attributions. Fourth is understanding the other person's position and their experience. And that's about taking the time, as we said, to listen and deeply understand. Fifth is being compassionate. You know, it's hard to hear negative feedback or that your colleagues find you difficult or that you've not been performing well. So, you know, it's about being compassionate, being present, empathizing, and keeping the higher purpose of our leadership in mind all of the time. We're here to deliver for children, students. And six is, it's really important in these conversations to have space and time and silence for listening and reflecting, both for you as a leader and the person you're talking with. And the more that we can create that space and time for thinking, for reflecting, for silence, the safer in a way it becomes. And of course, from a procedural perspective, as you know, all of your listeners will know, you have to document and make notes about the difficult conversation afterwards for both to use, so that you have a record of what's been discussed and agreed.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, and this is more a personal question to you, just out of interest for me, really, is do you think you're good at difficult conversations because you know this? Or do you still think, you know, or is it a struggle? Do you think in your life you've been good at them, or do you think, is that a strength or not?
I think I, like everybody, approach them with some feelings of trepidation and some anxieties, because, you know, we find conflict quite threatening as a species for all sorts of evolutionary reasons. I think what I've practiced over the years, I mean, when I was an undergraduate in university, I learned meditation, and practicing meditation has been part of my life for the last 50 years. And that's in a way, I suppose, what that is about learning to be present and practicing being present. And so I think practicing being present helps me in conversations, I think what it helps me to do most of all, Tom, is to listen and to listen deeply. And to be connected with the other person. And I think that's something we can all do. And in fact, it's self-reinforcing. When we listen deeply to another person and are present with them, we benefit as well. We have a sense of connection. Actually, the other interesting thing to mention in passing is when we look at the evidence around people being compassionate. So, for example, if you ask GPs to be extra compassionate in their interactions with patients over a two-week period, we see significant declines in their own anxiety, stress, and depression. So being present with the other, I think, is really the core of this, at the heart of this. And it's something that we can practice, at all of us, every day in our interactions. And it's a kind of, I suppose, an antidote to this frenetic spinning the hamster wheel, bouncing from one interaction to another kind of culture that we've created, and that we, you know, when we go on holiday, we reclaim some of that ability to be present and connect with others. And that ability to be present and connect with others is key to our own well-being. You know, the need for a sense of belonging and connection is core in human behavior. We're as likely to die from the effects of loneliness as we are from the effects of smoking or the effects of obesity. Mm. So I think practicing connection or presence in our interaction with others is something we can all do every day, whether it's with our children, our colleagues, you know, even our interactions in the supermarket or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, how do you, because you've kind of touched on that there, but I know there's a section in the book about how people recover from work stress. And I know you mentioned in that section about nature, connecting with nature. Yeah. You mentioned holidays and actually going, you know, taking yourself out of that situation for a bit. But I wondered whether it's possible for someone to recover from work stress on the job, or do they have to leave that job? I mean, is it possible for people to be able to recover within a job?
So, I mean, the stress, in a sense, is caused by the match between the work demands and resources you have available. So, you know, either you can reduce the work demands, have less work, or you need to have more resources, better support from your manager, better team working, better technology, better skill development. So in a broad sense, yes. But people, I think, find themselves often in job situations which feel harrowing, difficult, really exhausting. And we're faced with simple choices. We can change the job in the sense of changing the demands and the resources. And the team we work in is critical to that. That's a key factor. We can change the workload, for example. That's a key factor as well. If we can't change those things, then we're left with two choices. Either we stay in that situation and we accumulate more damage to our mental health and to our physiological health, or we leave and we find a different situation. And so I think that, you know, those are the three simple choices. More parochially and simply, during the course of a day, we know that work breaks are important. Having proper lunch breaks with colleagues are important. You know, there are things like
that. That's a huge issue in schools, actually, is time for break and lunch. You know, yeah. A lot of teachers are just running around scoffing a sandwich down their throat and then heading to the next lesson or the duty or whatever. There's very little time to sit down, you know.
And the problem is we've come to treat people in work as though they're some kind of resource or machine or entity, but we're human beings. We're soft. We have and incredible strengths, but we also have limitations. And the reality is that if we have proper breaks, and you know, that proper lunch breaks, some breaks where we have a kind of psychological detachment from the work, we know that has positive effects on people's ability to recover from stress at work. And we know that it helps them to be more effective in their work. So it's a self-defeating process in a way, just to just to kind of keep spinning the hamster wheel ever faster. I mean, one of the, and I've researched a lot on teams in various industries over the years, and what I've always been struck by, we started to do research in the early 90s on teams that were under pressure in healthcare, and we asked the kind of counterintuitive question, what happens if they stop and take time out, whether it's, you know, away days, or they have, they put in, as I've seen in some primary care teams, two practice meetings a week, or if they have, you know, if ward shifts have a half an hour or 15 minutes at the beginning of the shift and the end of the shift. And we've discovered that they're much more innovative and productive. And actually the research evidence internationally shows that teams that take time out on a regular basis to stop, reflect, review, are on average between 35 and 40% more productive. So, I mean, that's an incredible figure. That's based on combining the data from 49 separate published peer-reviewed studies. And what it tells us is that, you know, we human beings are much more effective when we have these times of stillness and the breaks, because they enable us to function more effectively. We recover recover our resources. We're more effective and powerful, and we're more creative.
Superb. Listen, Michael, we've got so much more to discuss, and we're already running out of time, actually. So I'm going to go to the news now. And then after the news, we're going to continue our conversation by thinking about leading compassionate cultures. And we're talking about attending, understanding, empathizing, helping again. But also I want to talk about this idea of inclusivity in leadership and why you think that's important, as well as leadership self-compassion. So what's that, and why is that important? So we'll be back in a few minutes, Michael, if you can stay with us.
Yeah, certainly.
Cheers.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. A new report published in The Guardian this week has highlighted a rise in extremist views and conspiracy theories amongst pupils in England. Interviewers from UCL's Institute of Education interviewed teachers, 50% of whom said they had heard far-right views expressed in their classrooms. 90% had also heard vaccine-related conspiracy theories. 75% had heard Islamophobic or misogynistic views, and almost all of the interviewed staff had heard racist language in school. The report comes as 13% of terrorism-related arrests in the last financial year were of those aged 18 or under, up from 5% on the previous year. Young people under 24 also made up almost 60% of extreme right-wing terror arrests. Oakwood High School, a West London secondary, is rolling out a series of socialisation lessons to help students following the pandemic restrictions. The sessions will include sitting students together at lunch, bonding activities, and extracurricular clubs to help students find like-minded friends. Students will also be offered counselling if they need support with their mental health, and a buddy from an older year group. The head, Mr. Cowling, said, "As a school and community, we must do all we can to help our young people get back on the right track, both emotionally, socially, and academically." That was your latest Teachers Talk Radio News.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, Visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you are enjoying the show so far. I've been talking extensively with Michael West about compassionate leadership, and we're going to be continuing the conversation in a moment to explore compassionate leadership cultures. Thanks for tuning in with us this morning. Call in, text in, and keep listening to Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Michael, we have talked so much about all these different elements of compassionate leadership. I've absolutely loved the conversation so far. I've taken so much away, and actually I've been busy writing notes myself, which is quite good. I was wondering, with this idea of like developing a compassionate culture, right? And I know that you touched on this earlier on anyway, but you've got your kind of attending, understanding, empathizing, and helping, the four elements of it. What about self-compassion for a leader? Where does that fit into this? And what is that and what is it not?
So in order to be, I think, truly compassionate in our interactions with others, I mean, we can all practice attending, understanding, empathizing, and helping. Mm. I think we make it far more powerful if we have also committed to being self-compassionate. So what I mean by that is that we, I think, must pay attention to ourselves. And I think people who are in public service jobs or human service jobs often find this quite difficult, the idea that I should listen to where I'm at, what's going on for me in this moment, learning to be present with myself in this moment. Am I feeling angry, overwhelmed, inadequate, ashamed? So being self-aware in the moment and then seeking to understand the challenges we face. Okay, why am I feeling this at this minute? Why am I feeling angry or irritated or ashamed or uncomfortable? And tuning into those feelings rather than pushing them away or denying them or being angry with ourselves for having such feelings, and then bringing a caring orientation, an empathic orientation to ourselves, self-care, as it were. I mean, we're all of us as deserving of love as every other human being on the planet. And when we bring that caring orientation towards ourselves, then we're more able to take wise action to help ourselves with, you know, what's going on. And why all of this is so important is that when we connect deeply with ourselves and authentically with ourselves in that way, we kind of connect more deeply with the core values that give our lives meaning, like compassion, like wisdom, like courage, like love. And when we connect more deeply with ourselves, then we're able to connect much more deeply and authentically with everyone we work with the students that we teach, actually with all of those we interact with. So it begins with having the courage to be self-compassionate and to, you know, to take action to help ourselves, to deal with some of these difficult emotions, and to do the nurturing things that we need to do to recover from the kind of stressful days we have.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that you talk about with regards to self-compassion in practice is caring for myself. And I'm just going to read this bit from the book that you've written here. The third caring element of self-compassion is the most difficult for many people, especially those who work in health and social care. The commitment to care for others may involve an impulse to heroic self-denial. Quote, I can't waste time looking after myself because I must devote my energies and attentions to patients or service users. The denial of one's own need for care jeopardizes our ability to provide high quality and compassionate care for others. And I think this is a key issue for teachers and education professionals as well, in terms of this idea that, you know, I have to give all of myself to the job of teaching because it's so important, it's vital, we can't waste a second of a lesson. And it is incredibly easy to forget about yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's, obviously you've mirrored that here in your kind of self-compassion in practice. You've also got, you're attending to myself, understanding the challenges I face, and helping or supporting myself. I don't know whether you want to dig into any of those a bit further or not.
Yeah, I mean, as you were reading that, I was thinking about, you know, it's been really hot here the last few days, and some of the plants outside haven't been getting the moisture that they need. And when that moisture arrives, then, you know, they flourish and become healthy and productive, and it's just the same. And I think that you know, we have to recognize what helps us to be happy. And in the end, you know, the purpose is, if there's one purpose in life, it's for people to have a happy life, and to and that happiness often comes from helping others. But if we don't take care of ourselves, then we're not in a position to really help others as well as we can. And, you know, we know about the five ways to well-being. By far and away, the most important is spending quality time with the people we love and who love us. Well, if we're just so busy with work that in the evenings we don't have time to be with our loved ones, or if we are with them, we're not actually with them, you know, with presence. And if we're just busy at the weekends all of the time with work, we're not spending that quality time. And, of course, it's about things like having exercise, being present in the moment, spending time in nature, continuing to learn and grow. Those are the things that help us to have a sense of well-being. And I've talked about recovery from work stress and the need in the evenings, you know, after work or on weekends, to engage in activities that give, you know, what Sabina Sonnentag at the University of Mannheim calls psychological detachment. So activities that take me away from all of that work stuff, and activities that give me a sense of mastery, whether it's, I don't know, cooking or playing a sport. And exercise, of course, is hugely important. And having proper work breaks, I've mentioned, and holidays, you know, and we know that holidays are helpful, although the effects fade within 10 days, 2 weeks. And the spending time in nature, the interesting stuff there is the kind of hierarchy, that the best seems to be blue spaces like sea, rivers, lakes, closely followed by green spaces like forests, hills, and then even urban green spaces like parks. But being outside at all under the sky is helpful to recover. And the really sad thing, Tom, that, you know, motivates me to get these messages across, is that we know that the people who are most in need of recovering from work stress are least likely to engage in these activities. So we need to raise awareness. And if people are not self-compassionate, they won't do these things. But self-compassion is at the core of our ability to be compassionate with others.
Yeah, and I've experienced personally kind of like quite a number of years ago now, I left a school and following that, it took me a hell of a long time to get back to a place where I felt moderately normal. I did practice those things during that period, and it did help. Like I remember there was like this specific walk I did, and I used to spend a few hours down there. It's like a lake, and you know, it was, yeah, there were certain things I did that helped me in that period, but it took a hell of a long time to recover. And they always talk about, like, I do think in, and it'd be the same in healthcare, education, the kind of caring professions, if you like, I think some people reach breaking point and they just like snap. Do you know what I mean? And then I wouldn't say they're finished. You can always come back, but there is a point, there's like a breaking point, and maybe that builds up over. I mean, you talk about burnout as well in the book, and maybe that builds up over time, but then they kind of reach that point.
Yeah, and I think it's we've got, I don't know, seduced by these ideas of targets and numbers and rankings and outcomes, and have failed in the basic task, as you described from your experience, of nurturing our communities, whether it's a community of a school, of a group of teachers, of a group of healthcare professionals, of people working together in a hospital or a primary healthcare team or a voluntary sector organization, that health and happiness are based on creating cultures of support and belonging, and that we should be vigilant for signs that people are having difficulties long before they reach breaking point. It's not a healthy or effective way to, which is why I said at the beginning, I think, you know, what we're seeing is a leadership crisis or a failure of leadership in many of our organizations, because people have been so damaged. And we kind of get to these positions. We've got to this position almost without seeing, what a mess we've made. But I think it is. I think the pandemic is a wake up call for all of us. We have to live a different way, a different life. We have to nurture ourselves and our environments. Mm. You know, we have to be compassionate towards the planet. We have to connect with the planet and other species if we're to survive and have happy lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I thought we'd finish with quite a big question, which is about nurturing kind of commitment in work and people's commitments in work. And you highlight in the book three key areas there in terms of getting people to, presumably, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is about getting people to really feel invested and committed to the work that they're doing and feel like they're a part of it and so on. And you highlight autonomy and control, belonging and contribution and competence. And I wonder whether, just like in summary, you could maybe go through each of those and just I can read them out if you want, but I've got the book in front of me now. But there's those three areas and how each one of those helps people to feel more committed in work.
So we know that, you know, there's all these problems of stress, and people say, okay, what we need to do is have mindfulness programs or resilience training. Those are treating symptoms, not underlying causes. The causes of stress at work are we're not meeting people's core work needs. And there are three core needs that people have, as you say. There's a need for autonomy and control, a sense of volition, a voice and influence, to be able to do work that's in accordance with my values. It's about having voice and influence, being listened to, control, you know, having some control over my work and the workplace, working in a context of learning and support rather than fear and blame, and working in a context that's fair and transparent and open. Second is the need for a sense of belonging, to feel valued and respected and supported, cared for in the teams and organizations I work in. As I said earlier, the need to belong is fundamental to human well-being. And third is the need for competence, the need to be able to do work effectively, to feel a sense of effectiveness. And the number one factor that inhibits that is this issue we talked about, chronic excessive workload, which prevents people from doing work that they feel is of the right standard and is effective. And competence is also aided by having continuing growth and development of one's skills, and by having good, supportive, compassionate supervision. So all of those three needs need to be met. I call them the ABC of work needs. All three must be met for people to have to be well and to be intrinsically motivated at work. And I argue, would argue strongly, we need to address those needs. I'm not arguing against, you know, mindfulness or yoga or resilience training. But I'm saying that's not the solution. It's great to have those things, but the solution is identifying how we're going to better meet those core needs for those we lead in the workplace.
That makes absolute sense. Finally, Michael, just to kind of conclude on this, and obviously I want to thank you hugely for coming on to Teachers Talk Radio, but we'll leave that till the end. But I wanted you to maybe just give some tips and advice to leaders, maybe leaders in education, obviously it's about Teachers Talk Radio, but tips and advice to leaders who want to practice compassionate leadership or maybe find out more about it. What advice or tips, you know, if you were to give some nuggets to them of what they could do or should do, what would you say?
Well, of course, I'd say go to my book. It's got lots of practical resources, websites and videos and short discussion questions. Health Education and Improvement Wales has created a website, Gwella, G-W-E-L-L-A, which has loads and loads of free resources, open source material around developing compassionate leadership. But most important, I would say, is practice those four skills and, you know, make them part of your being, not something you just do in the workplace, and be self-compassionate, because that's where it all begins. Having the courage to be self-compassionate enables us to connect more deeply with others, and that's very, very powerful in terms of our relationships, but also in terms of our own well-being and happiness.
Fantastic. Michael, thanks ever so much for coming on today to the show. And this will be available as a podcast to listen back. I will share the link via my own Twitter account, which is at Rogers History, and also at TT Radio 2021. We'll plug it out as well for all our subscribers and people who are interested in this, and there are many. So thank you ever so much, because I've learned so much today, this morning.
It's been a huge pleasure to talk with you, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Take care. Bye for now. That was Michael West, CBE. And just before I go, I am going to talk about my guest next week, which is actually Catherine Birbal Singh. I can't wait to talk to Catherine again. The last time I did that was on one of my school leader interviews about 2 years ago. So it'll be an opportunity to catch up with Catherine about the goings-on in education. If you don't know who Catherine Birbal Singh is, then just go to Google and type in Catherine Birbal Singh. She's the head teacher of the Michaela Free School, social and education commentator, influencer, and just general, I have to say, for me personally, somebody who always makes me think, always challenges the way my kind of cognitive processes go. And I know that's the same for many others. So that'll be an unmissable one next Thursday on the morning break.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programs to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics.
That's it for the morning break this morning. I hope you can join me again the same time next week at 9 a.m. And if you're listening back on the podcast on ttradio.org, thanks for listening, and I will see you again soon.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.